Welcome to PEMBA On Demand, Physician Leaders Making a Difference. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. PEMBA On Demand is produced for physicians seeking professional development. We discuss a wide range of topics on the podcast, including successful innovations in a variety of different healthcare disciplines, current issues in healthcare, career development, and healthcare leadership. Welcome to episode 37 of PEMBA On Demand. Our show today is The Key to Better Healthcare, Physician Leadership, and PEMBA. Our guest today is Dr. Don Leiter. Dr. Leiter has been a core faculty member of the PEMBA program since its inception. He recently retired to focus on other pursuits, which I'm looking forward to him sharing with you. Don's clinical background and training is in pediatrics. Early in his career, his passion for quality improvement, education, and leadership propelled him down a path he had not considered. He's going to be sharing with us his thoughts and insights tonight about healthcare and physician leadership. So once again, buckle up and get ready for a fascinating conversation about physician leadership and making healthcare better. Stay tuned. You won't want to miss a minute of this. So Don, it's great to have you on the show. Welcome to PEMBA On Demand.
Well, thanks, Norm. It's a real privilege and an honor to be here.
Well, I don't know if everybody realizes what a force you've been in the background of PEMBA On Demand since the middle of 2023, and we started talking about transitioning the Physician Leadership Symposia into a podcast and live stream format. But you really have really helped me and helped the university kind of make that transition. And I can't thank you enough for your support. It's a real honor for me to have you finally on the show as a guest.
Well, I have to say, I mean, when you came up with the idea, it was a little bit different for me because you can tell a little old here. The concept of a podcast to do what we've been doing was kind of unusual, but boy, it sure has taken off and you've done a great job. I have been so impressed with your capabilities in doing this. I'm just blown away every time I watch one of your podcasts. It's just amazing.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoy it. Nerdy and geeky. So this has been fun for me.
And you got personality, man. You got personality.
Well, it helps when you're having fun doing something like this. And hopefully Absolutely. The audience appreciates that as well, because we brought a lot of good content over the past year. We released our first podcast back in the fall of 2023. So we've been doing this for over a year now, and we've had some great guests on the show.
We have focused on alums, and I think the idea of getting some of the folks who've been through the PEMBA program and who've actually taken what they've learned and made something of it, I think that's probably one of the great strengths of the program.
Yes, I agree with you. I agree. It was fun to go back down to PEMBA this year in December for the graduation and to meet some of the new alumni. So I hadn't been back in many years, partly because of COVID and partly because of other things that were happening in my professional career, but it was great to be back on campus. I really enjoyed that.
Well, I hope you were able to find a parking place. It's getting harder and harder.
I used public transportation, or actually university transportation, all the time. So
smart, very smart.
Well, maybe we could start by talking a little bit about, as I mentioned in the intro, you've been involved with PEMBA really since the inception in 1997. It's amazing to me to think about how long PEMBA has been in existence. But maybe you could talk a little bit about the inspiration what really inspired you to join the PEMBA faculty as this program was getting off the ground?
You know, that's a great question, because one of the things that I think has probably pushed me more and more to be involved with PEMBA has been trying to put physicians in a position of assuming leadership in the healthcare system. One of the things, and you may remember this because I've said this to every class for 28 years, is physicians are among the only people who have had the experience of actually sitting across from people, patients, and giving them good news, giving them bad news, helping them through very difficult times. And that, plus the administrative skills that they learn in PEMBA, gives them a certain amount of empathy that most other folks in administrative positions don't have. And the other thing is most physicians, we like to at least think, if we don't, but we like to think we have a creative side. And this kind of expands an area of concepts where you can be creative and also justify some of the great ideas that you have from a business sense, which is very important in today's healthcare environment.
I know you've been involved with the PEMBA program for a long time. As you look back at the 28 years that you've been engaged in teaching physicians and being part of a physician executive MBA, what are a couple of the things that stand out to you that you're most proud of accomplishing during your tenure with the program?
You know, there's so many, it's really kind of hard to pick out one or two, but one of the things I think is probably that stands out for me is the number of people who have gone on to leadership positions in a variety of different parts of the healthcare delivery system, all the way from the payer side, all the way to the healthcare delivery side, in DME and in a variety of other kinds of positions in the healthcare system. And we've made them much more effective as leaders in all of these different areas. To me, that's been one of the keys, is not to necessarily redirect somebody into a particular kind of position like a CMO or a CIO or something like that, but rather to give them the tools to attain the highest level of performance where they are and where they want to go. And that's been one of the more exciting things. We have these projects that are part of the PEMBA program called Organizational Action Projects. We used to call them year-long projects, but that sounded too tedious, so we changed it to Organizational Action Projects. And really, I have been so impressed with the variety and the accomplishments that people have actually made in these kinds of projects during their tenure with the PEMBA program.
It's fascinating to me. Now I look back, I completed my PEMBA program in 2008, so it's coming up on 20 years. And to look back and remember what it was like to sit in the classroom with young physicians who aspired to leadership roles, and then to look at, as you said, what their journey has evolved into over the last 20 years is pretty amazing.
Yeah. And the places that people have been now, and that's one of the reasons that I love having the alumni on your podcast, because the places people have been are just unbelievable, both nationally in the United States, but also internationally.
Yes.
We've got international graduates who have attained leadership positions all across the world. And to me, it just gives me chills when I think about it.
So we're going to pivot a little bit. I'm interested in having you share some of your thoughts about, kind of talked about the role that you had with the PEMBA program and the importance of developing physician leaders. How do you see the role of physician leaders evolving over the next 5 to 10 years? Healthcare has changed massively in the last 30 years. Looking into your crystal ball, where do you see the impact of physician leadership being in the next 5 to 10 years? I guess maybe a better question is, do you see it changing, or do you see it continuing along the same lines that we've seen over the past 20 or 30 years?
I think there's going to be more of a challenge for physician leaders to maintain that patient focus, quite frankly. We have seen over the last, you know, I remember giving talks back in 2004, 2005. Believe it or not, I can actually remember that. But I remember giving talks back then that 25% of physicians are employed and the rest were pretty much in private practice. Now, that statistic is pretty much flipped. The vast majority of physicians are employed, and they're employed by large health systems, which makes it much more complex and much more difficult for the frontline physician and the frontline practitioner to actually accomplish the patient care goals that they want to accomplish. It's up to physician leaders to make sure that the resources are available so that that can happen. We are seeing now a big move into value-based care. What essentially that is going to be doing is going to be flipping the traditional paradigm of we send a bill to an insurance company, the insurance company sends a check every once in a while. And pretty soon we're going to become effectively the insurance company, because we're going to get fixed amounts to take care of a population of patients, which means we'll be assuming risk. And the physician leaders are the ones who are going to have to be able to help frontline physicians understand how to manage that risk, how to implement things like clinical guidelines, things like that, so that they can achieve the goals that they want to achieve with patients, and at the same time, do it within the economic constraints that we're going to have.
I think it would be great if we could take a little bit more of a deep dive into value-based care. And I had asked you to kind of prepare to talk a little bit about that. But before we move into that, one of the things you mentioned just sort of struck a chord with me. Physicians typically are seen as having a tremendous number of skills, tremendous amount of knowledge, what you might refer to as hard skills or the technical skills. When you were starting the PEMBA program, was there an intentional design to help physicians develop the skills, the soft skills that are necessary for physician leadership? And how well accepted was that? And what has PEMBA done to try to incorporate that skill development into the PEMBA program?
You're going to bring a tear to my eye now. I remember the meeting well. I called myself the token physician on the PEMBA core faculty because I was the only physician among all these PhDs. And I remember very well, everybody kind of turned to me at one point and said, what's the one thing that physicians need to take away from this program? And I said, the one thing that physicians need to learn from the program is how to work as a member of a team and not the leader of the team. And to me, that's one of the keys that physicians have to learn. We are so accustomed to walking into the hospital, making rounds, writing orders, saying, do this, do that, and people do things. It doesn't work that way in the rest of the world. And so physicians have to learn really how to interact with people and how to negotiate as opposed to command. And that's kind of difficult for some physicians. I've worked with physicians for whom that's almost an impossibility, to be honest. But at the same time, one of the goals of the PEMBA leadership curriculum is to give physicians those skills. And I think the curriculum has evolved over the years to become very good at that.
Great. We're going to pivot now into some slides that you can share some information. And you sent these to me. The first slides have to do with something that I know you've been involved with for many, many years as well, which is the Baldrige framework. So I'm wondering if we could transition to the slides right now, and maybe you can talk a little bit about Baldrige and its impact on healthcare and those kinds of things.
Sure. I'd like to do that. Now you're getting into my angle here. One of the things that we do in the performance improvement and the quality improvement curriculum, so we think both tactically and strategically. And tactically, we use Lean Six Sigma as our tactical approach, is what we try to teach the physicians. But strategically, physician leaders have to have that overview. And I think Baldrige is actually what does that. Let's go to the next slide. Okay. And I'm going to give you sort of the flavor of what we talk about when we delve into Baldrige. First of all, try to convince folks that Baldrige is good both for new businesses and for existing businesses. Just click on the next. Both existing healthcare businesses and new healthcare businesses can benefit from this approach because it provides the framework within which you can develop a high performance focus. And those values that are created in the Baldrige program, and I'm going to show you a very big graphic of that. We're not going to delve into that to any great extent. But those values very carefully align with the values that we have in most health systems. Health systems, and particularly physician-led health systems, are very patient-oriented. And so one of the things that we really try to emphasize for physicians is that Baldrige provides that patient-centered focus, they call it a customer focus in Baldrige, but it's patient-centered focus for healthcare systems. Let's go to the next slide. And this is just the Baldrige. We just sort of give them the overview of what the Baldrige Performance Excellence Program is. And you had mentioned that it might be good to have some very basic kinds of ideas, but Baldrige has been internationally recognized. And there are actually programs like Baldrige in various countries around the world. Baldrige is a U.S.-based program. It was created actually in 1987 by a fellow named Malcolm Baldrige, which is the name of the program. He was the Secretary of Commerce back then for Ronald Reagan. And he was very instrumental in getting this program started in order to make the United States more competitive in a number of different industries. And so one of the things that the Baldrige Performance Excellence Program is designed to do is to make organizations more competitive as well as more effective. In other words, it's balancing that efficiency and effectiveness that's so important in any kind of organization. The framework that exists is, well, it's important for a number of reasons, but one of the things that it brings out is what are the best practices, both in business and quality improvement. Baldrige recipients, or Baldrige applicants, actually, folks who apply for the Baldrige Award, have to tell the Baldrige program, this is how we do things, and these are the results that we get from doing it this way. So it becomes relatively, I don't want to say easy, but it becomes straightforward in terms of trying to determine where the best practices are. And the good part about the Baldrige program is the Baldrige recipients all share their applications, which describe these processes. So people in the industry that, for example, healthcare industry, can get these applications and see what these organizations are doing that are making them so positive and effective. So one of the things, and healthcare applicants have really grown in the Baldrige program. In the first few years, it was all industry. IBM won and some car manufacturers won, organizations like that. But healthcare picked up on it in about 2001, 2002, and it has just grown tremendously. So healthcare is an important part of the Baldrige program right now. Let's go to the next part of this slide here. I like to always tell people what it's not, though, because a lot of folks are accustomed to the audit approach. I mentioned NCQA here, other kinds of oversight organizations like public health departments and things like that, that come in and say, okay, these are our standards. You have to meet these standards. And so what you have to do is you have to make sure that you're addressing each one of those things and you're doing it in a way that is acceptable to them. But one of the things that Baldrige does is it says, how do you do these things? We want to know what you're doing and the results you're getting, as opposed to saying, you have to do something this way. It's not a punitive approach. It's a very positive approach, and it really encourages organizations to pull out the best of their activities so that they can demonstrate those to the rest of the world and also demonstrate their positive results from those very insightful activities. Let's go to the next slide. Busy slide, I mentioned the core values, and I don't know if folks are going to be able to read all these, but Baldrige has a number of core values that are of great importance to the program. And I think one of the things, and go ahead and click the next, one of the things that the core values do is they really shape the Baldrige program. They shape the questions that are asked in the criteria. They shape the results that are expected in terms of how well an organization is actually performing. So in essence, these core values, and you notice it's things like ethics, transparency, focus on performance, those kinds of things are very important in any organization. So I always try to emphasize that those core values are the core values that should be at the heart of any organization, healthcare, whatever kind of organization. But those core values have such an important part of creating the basis for the Baldrige program. Let's go to the next slide. So, and I just very quickly go into strategic planning, which is category two. Well, in the old criteria, there are new criteria that just came out this year. But in the old criteria, category two was strategic planning. And it's important to note that Baldrige does not prescribe, but they ask a series of questions. How do you do strategic planning? How do you make sure that all of your core competencies are leveraged? How do you make sure that all of your important clients are addressed? So making sure that everything is addressed in the strategic plan. And then also, how do you look forward and think about what the strategic plan is going to do in the future? Most of the time when people are doing strategic planning, they want to just get it done, get it over with, put it on the shelf and put it away. I've worked in organizations like that, and it's not effective at all. But the Baldrige approach to strategic planning, or the Baldrige framework for strategic planning, really helps develop a strategic plan that's effective and can be deployed. Let's go to the next part of this. And then we talk about deploying strategy using that framework. That's making sure you have the resources, the workforce, making sure you're measuring things correctly so you know if in fact your plan is being implemented appropriately and you're getting the results that you're that you are anticipating. But the other thing that's important is the ability to adapt to change, because no strategic plan is ever perfect. It's never going to predict what's going to happen in 2 or 3 or 4 years. So you have to be able to adapt to change. And that's one of the other important ways that Baldrige requests that you describe how you're going to make sure that happens. And then making sure that you're looking not just at what you want to do, but also what you've done in the past, what you've done well, what you've failed at, and then how you can improve that past performance, comparing to competitors and making sure that you've got the resources available. So let's go to the next slide. I like to always point this out. This is a picture of a Baldrige training several years ago. And I was examiner and a judge with the Baldrige program for almost about 19 years. I always like to say that I was pretty good at recruiting folks into becoming examiners. And there are some examples in that picture of the examiners in the Baldrige program that are from our programs at the University of Tennessee.
That's great.
So that's pretty much what I wanted to talk about with the Baldrige framework.
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. Before we move into value-based care, I wonder, you'd mentioned that you had some graphics of an example, healthcare organizations that have implemented the Baldrige framework. And it sounds like it's really been a thing since around 2000 or so, after it started out in manufacturing and industry. Could we take a look at that? Just a second?
Yeah.
I think this would be a good place for you to kind of share that with us.
You betcha. And this is kind of an old graphic that I used a few years ago. And this was Baldrige recipients from healthcare recipients from 2002 through 2016. I'm not sure folks can see this real well, but there are a number of different organizations that they might recognize. Henry Ford Medical Center, for example, in Detroit, very famous. St. Luke's in Kansas City. I've been privileged as working as an examiner and as a judge to actually visit some of these places and see how they do what they do. And some of the things, you know, for example, Henry Ford has a Center for Innovation, and they fund people come to the Center for Innovation with innovative ideas as to how they can make things better, how they might create a new medical device or something like that. And they provide funds to help them develop those ideas. Those kinds of things are what actually make Henry Ford stand out in the world healthcare delivery system. So it's things like that that we've seen over the years that have made these organizations very high quality and high performance. I personally have always been impressed, all the way from way back in the day, the first Baldrige recipient was in St. Louis. It was the Sisters of St. Mary, and it was a health system in the Midwest that actually received the award back then. And it was very revolutionary because they were doing some things in quality improvement that had not really been done before. And so SSM Health really became one of the paradigms of the Baldrige approach back then, and really helped a lot of different organizations. And that's the other thing. It's kind of a community. It's really kind of neat that way, because the Baldrige recipients, first of all, I mentioned they put their applications out for everybody to see so they can see what they've been doing. But they also are very happy to send speakers to various places to have people visit them and see how they do what they do, so that they can take those ideas back and show them to others and to develop them in their own organizations. It's very much like what I would hope that our PEMBA graduates are doing as well, in terms of sharing their great ideas with others. That's kind of what we do in quality, you know, Norm?
Yep.
That's in performance improvement and quality. It's not, hey, I'm going to do this and I'm going to make a lot of money and I'm going to keep it to myself. But it's, look, I've done this. I've improved patient mortality rates for cardiac surgery or whatever, or let's just say for pediatric otitis media. That's my area. But I've done these things and I've shown some really good results and patients have benefited from this. So I'm sharing this with others. It's very much like what we learned, I think, what we learned in medical, what I learned in medical school.
I notice is looking at the award recipients, I think just scanning it quickly, I only noticed one medical center, North Mississippi, Tupelo,
yeah,
that was a repeat awardee.
Well, North Mississippi was interesting because back in, what was it, 2006, I think they won it as a hospital. But then they reapplied in 2011, 2012, I think it was, and they applied as a health system. So they started as just a hospital, but then they brought in the whole health system after a few years and did another Baldrige application. Now, one of the things that's important to understand is nobody, I shouldn't say nobody, I'm not aware of anybody who has won the Baldrige Award with their first year application. Mm-hmm. Almost everybody, we always like to say it's a journey. And what that means is you have a site, you have a team of examiners come and look at your application, look at your organization and make recommendations as to, and not even recommendations, but ask questions. How do you do this? And how is that going to actually show the improvements that you want to show? And we then score the application based on that. And it's usually two or three iterations. SSM, I think, took two or three. Others have taken as many as four. But usually after about three or four iterations, you really learn from the experts that come. The examiners are people from a variety of industries. The teams that I've been on with Baldrige have included engineers from Boeing, people from IBM, other physicians from other organizations, people from state government, national government. It's just a tremendous mix of people who come and look at these things and bring the perspective of other industries so that you're not just focused just on the healthcare perspective, but you've got a broader perspective that it brings.
Would you mind talking a little bit? There's a lot of healthcare organizations that kind of pride themselves achieving awards like the Magnet Certification for Nursing or U.S. News and World Report. How, in your opinion, does Baldrige, how is it similar and how is it dissimilar from those types of award recognition systems?
That's a really good question. And I think part of the answer has to be with regard to the comprehensiveness of the Baldrige program. Baldrige looks at the entire organization. And when you look at the criteria, there are seven or six different areas that are looked at. And they really, as I mentioned, it's the strategic focus of the entire organization. When you think about things like magnet programs and other and lab awards and things like that, those usually fixate on specific departments. Mm-hmm. So it's not as, those are not as comprehensive as Baldrige is. Baldrige is more of an organizational or a system kind of an award.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back and talk a little bit about value-based care.
Yes. Everybody is getting used to this conversation now. And it's interesting because part of my career I spent in, well, I've been chief quality officer for health plans and I've been chief quality officer for health systems. And it's been interesting to take what I've learned from the health plans and translate it into work in a health system. And part of the challenge I think we face in healthcare is we're accustomed to, it started back, here you go again, here's the gray hair. But it started back in the 60s when we had Medicare, when Medicare came about. And all of a sudden we were funded for things that had never been paid for before, where it had always been sort of charity care and always done sort of at the behest of good-hearted physicians and good-hearted hospital administrators. But when Medicare came about, all of a sudden we were in Medicaid then, we were paid for things that were never funded before. And so we started thinking, oh, well, gosh, then we must be worth a lot. This is me talking here. we must be worth a lot more than we think. And so all of a sudden, the cost of healthcare as part of GDP started growing. And we have now achieved a level of about 18% of GDP, where in other countries, 9 to 10% of GDP is pretty common. And those other countries oftentimes have better health statistics in terms of longevity, in terms of morbidity, and in other words, chronic illness and things like that, than we are. But we're still spending more. And so one of the ways we're trying to deal with that is to take the concept that we have from insurance and transpose that onto the healthcare delivery system. And that's what's called value-based care. Why don't we look at the first slide here? And I always like to start this by mentioning that value is defined. And this is something that we talk about in healthcare. It's a little bit different than it is in business. But in business, we say value is quality divided by cost. So in other words, value is directly related to quality and indirectly related to cost. But in healthcare, quality is defined as outcomes. In other words, how well are people doing in our health system? Are they getting better? Experience, patient experience. In other words, are they satisfied with what we're doing? Do they like the interactions that they have with our health system? And then safety. How safe is the system? Is it causing injuries because it's an unsafe system? And of course, cost lives by itself in the denominator there. And that's because it's such a burden right now in the United States. And we're seeing a real pushback by a variety of different publics in the United States economy to the cost of healthcare. So we think of outcomes in terms of clinical, functional, societal, and system. So in other words, how are we doing as far as making people clinically better? Are they functionally better? In other words, they can have a really nice looking scar, but in fact, can they go back and do the work that they've been doing before? Societal, are we actually improving the overall work of society by the work that we do? And then of course, the system, how is the healthcare system doing in terms of outcomes, both financial and clinical outcomes?
One question before we move on to the one of the things that we focus on, I think increasingly as we compare the U.S. healthcare system to other countries, is we're looking at metrics like longevity, maintaining health rather than recovering from disease. Obesity is certainly one of the big epidemics. What is the prevalence of obesity, the prevalence of type 2 diabetes? Our focus historically has been on how do we take someone who has a chronic disease and try to make them better? How do we take someone who has heart disease and improve them? And the U.S., I think, arguably has the best system in the world for treating acute complications of chronic disease. But I'd be interested in your opinion about whether we need to start looking at different outcomes than payers have historically incorporated into their value-based care and incentive-based programs.
You know, Norm, I can tell you're a Pemba grad because you're very insightful. That's exactly what we need to do. We need to be looking at those clinical outcomes. Like I said, you know, how clean is my scar kind of thing. We need to start thinking more in terms of the functional outcomes and then how those functional outcomes translate into improvements in society. So, and that's really part of the challenge I think that we face now. We're getting a lot better at measuring functional outcomes. Years ago, when I first started doing this kind of stuff, long time ago, we had almost no ways of doing functional outcome measurement. But now we're getting a lot better at measuring functional outcomes. In other words, once I've repaired that fracture, is that joint completely functional? Is there a full range of motion? Is that individual able to actually do the work that they were doing before? So in essence, we're getting better at that. We still have a ways to go on it. This is part of the continuous improvement process, is making those measurements better over time. That's a great point. So the experience factor here is both satisfaction from a patient standpoint and a provider standpoint, but also engagement. And that is The classic question there is, okay, how engaged is this person with our healthcare system? In other words, their cousin came to them and said, where should I go and get my doctor? And if they don't immediately say, oh, go to my doctor because he's the best doctor ever, then you're probably not getting the level of engagement that you want. Getting people engaged gets them not just satisfied with what's going on, but also willing to actually be involved with their care, as well as in getting other folks involved with the system so that you can, from the system standpoint, it helps the system grow, but also from the patient's and from the provider standpoint, it helps them better able to determine what works and what doesn't work and how they can continually make their system better. Let's go to the next one, which is safety. And heaven knows we've got our list of errors and harm. There was a book that came out in the early 2000s, or maybe it was the late 1999. And the title of the book was Above All, Do No Harm. And one of the things that was pointed out was that we're actually have a fairly high error rate in healthcare. And these are mistakes that are remediable because we can actually use the quality improvement programs that have been developed over the years and make things better. So from the standpoint of safety, quality improvement really targets these kinds of things. We look at errors, we look at the harm that's done by medical procedures, and we redesign systems, we redesign processes so that we can reduce or eliminate those. And then let's talk a little bit about costs. Let's talk about direct and indirect costs. Direct costs, well, we're not going to get into that to a very large extent here, but the direct costs are those costs that are actually created by the care that we're actually providing to patients. Indirect costs are those background costs, you know, for example, medical legal insurance that we pay, utilities, lights, heat, things like that, all of those indirect costs that are partly responsible for the cost of care. So we have to be looking at all those different kinds of costs as we try to make the system better. So let's go to the next slide. And I like this graphic because it talks a little bit about how we need to be integrating the healthcare system. And that's what has to happen in a value-based care system. Patients have to be the center of the system. And all of the different things that we do, ambulatory care, inpatient care, home health, social services, all these different services that we provide have to be focused on the patient, not on, I've got my little kingdom here, I want to make sure that I'm making money, but in fact, making sure that the patient is getting what he or she needs. Let's go to the next graphic here. And the patient-centered care model takes all of these things and puts them together and makes the patient at the center of, there's a model, actually a model of care, where the patient is at the center of care. And all these programs are coordinated. This is where the physician needs a strategic view of patient care. And that's one reason I like the Baldrige program, because it helps bring that strategic view. But on the other hand, knowing what components are important and knowing what those components actually provide to achieve that patient care is of great importance. And that to me is one of the places where physicians can really shine. Let's go to the next slide. And I'm not gonna go into this to any great extent, but this just talks a little bit more about the patient-centered model, what all of the different services are. They're very complex, but at the same time, they're also important from the standpoint of the physician understanding what it takes to actually achieve that care. And this final slide is really to hopefully to emphasize that this is care across the continuum. This is not just care, what I do in my office or what I do in the operating room or what I do in the emergency department. But this is, okay, now that I've finished my procedure and the patient's going to the next level of care, what's going to happen there? And I have to be concerned about that as a good provider, but I also need as a physician leader to make sure that the appropriate services are available for that patient to make sure they're getting the care they need. So coordinating that care across the continuum is something that takes both a clinical and an administrative view so that you can make sure, number one, that the clinical aspects are being addressed, but also from an administrative standpoint, that the resources are available to make sure that happens. So I think, is that the last slide?
We got a couple more slides here with...
I wanted to just mention very quickly. Value-based care is based on a number of different layers. And we're not going to go into these, of course, but we spend a great deal of time in the PEMBA program going through each one of these different layers. Many of these, for folks who are familiar with the healthcare delivery system and healthcare payers, they know that utilization management, case management, population health management, those are things that have traditionally been done by payers, but now they're going to be done more and more by providers. And I noted over on the other side, the value-based care is what we call a STEEP criteria, safe, timely, effective, efficient, equitable, patient-centered. Those should be the criteria we use to judge whether or not the care is being done appropriately. And again, that new collaborative model that melds administrative and medical care, those are the things that have to be done in order to be able to really achieve effective value-based care. We're just at the beginning of that. We're a couple steps into it now, but we've got a long way to go, and we're going to see some big changes over the next few years. And that's what we want to make sure that our docs who are in the PEMBA program are prepared to lead.
Thank you, Don, for the presentation and covering the Baldrige development programs that you've been involved with. I know that you've been very passionate about that, and also giving us kind of a high-level flyover of value-based care has been really helpful.
You can tell I'm passionate about these things, right?
Absolutely. I think that to me always stood out. And your presentations and the presentations of all the faculty we had at PEMBA, that was one of the things that impressed me the most, is how passionate, whether I was listening to finance or marketing or quality improvement and value-based care lectures, everybody that taught in the program, I think, was just, they were there because of passion, not because they had to be there or those kinds of things. So I think it really just made that experience tremendous for me. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your own involvement with PEMBA. I mean, obviously, PEMBA for me was a very influential mental process in my professional career. How did your involvement with PEMBA influence your professional development, the trajectory that you took?
Well, as I mentioned, I was chief quality officer for health plans and for health systems. And that was very influential on what I taught in PEMBA, because I would bring my experience in those organizations to the classroom. And hopefully that was helpful in terms of helping people understand how the system worked, as well as how it should be made better. Because one of the things that I was continually on people's cases about when I was in those positions is, you know, we're in a performance excellence kind of environment. We need to be thinking about how we're going to make things better. And so PEMBA both influenced that, because, and I've written some books about it too. And the reason I wrote the books was to codify those things so that folks can really understand how all these pieces fit together. And what I think PEMBA helped me do that. And I really appreciate the experience I had with PEMBA in order to bring all these things together.
That's great. Before we move on to my last question, your comment about books, I wonder if you have consumer of the written word. Now I would say I'm more of an avid consumer of Audible, because I do so much. If I sit down and try to read a book at night, I usually fall asleep. So I use Audible to help. For people who are interested in process improvement, value-based care, you mentioned you wrote a couple of books. Maybe you could share those with us, and I can include those in the show notes for the show for people who are interested, or other books that you found very helpful and influential as you started to get more and more engaged with quality improvement.
Sure. I'll send you some links to those.
Great. I'd appreciate that. So we'll include those in the show notes for everybody who's listening. And hopefully you'll have an opportunity to take advantage of some of those insights and the learnings as well. So my last question is kind of germane to none of the things that we've talked about so far. I try to ask everybody, all the alumni who come on the show, what their most memorable moment from PEMBA is. What's the thing that they remember the most? What are one or two experiences or special moments that you've had while you were teaching PEMBA that you could share with us?
I think the one that stands out the most is it happened actually about, I think it was the second or the third year of Pemba. And we had a fellow who was a geriatric psychiatrist, and he had planned a trip to the Himalayas during the time he was in Pemba, but he didn't want to miss anything. And I think we were, if not the first, we were among the very early health or educational programs that actually did online teaching. So this guy hooked up his computer in the Himalayas via satellite so that he could make the cyber class. And so I'm teaching the cyber class. I don't even remember what it was about at this point, but I'm teaching the cyber class, and I always watch the notes over on the side. And all of a sudden he pops up a note and says, "We have somebody in our hiking party turning blue." And of course, he's a psychiatrist. And so people start with, "Well, you might want to see if he's depressed," you know, the usual stuff. But then the cardiologist and the ER docs started clicking in. "Okay, well, check his pulse, check his, you know, check his eyes." They were going through all this stuff about how to manage this. And I can just see this guy over there trying to manage this guy who's turned blue. He's probably the only physician in the hiking party. But I mean, talk about a hoot. I just sticks out. And how many years ago was that? 25, 26 years? It's been like that.
That's interesting. Well, it's just another way a network of physicians can add benefit to your experience. In this case, it might be not the benefit we would anticipate, but
their clinical teaching a psychiatrist CPR by telemedicine, it was a unique experience.
I imagine that was. I can see why that was a memorable experience that you haven't forgotten. That's well done. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule and joining us. For those of you, again, who don't know, Don and I have had numerous challenges to overcome to record the podcast. Last night, when we were getting ready to record it, Consumers Power shut my power off. And so we rescheduled it for 24 hours later. And luckily, we haven't had any power interruptions during this recording session. Yeah. So thank you for sticking it out and hanging in there. And thank you especially for helping make what Pemba On Demand has become. And just, you've made Pemba what it is as well. And I'm sure all of the alumni would want me to express our gratitude to you for all the years of work that you've put in to make Pemba what it is today.
Well, thank you, Norm. As I said, it's an honor, a privilege, and quite honestly, it's a labor of love. You know, it's something that I really think hopefully we're going to have a great influence on the future of healthcare.
Well, thank you. And thank you all for listening to the podcast. I'll look for another episode in 2 weeks. We look forward to having you continue to gain some advantages and some benefit from our programs. Good night, everybody.
Pemba On Demand is released biweekly every other Thursday and available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Castos, or Overcast. Please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast player by clicking the subscribe button. Add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could share the podcast with your friends or colleagues. You can also listen to our podcasts on our YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/@PembaOn-demand, all one word, no spaces. Please hit the like button and subscribe. Also, if you have any comments or questions regarding this or other episodes, please feel free to add them into the comment section on our YouTube channel. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to our website and our YouTube channel in the show notes. The website is tiny.utk.edu/PembaOnDemand, all one word. There's no hyphen in that URL. You will find the links to the episodes there. Please also check the show notes for links that were discussed in the show today. Take good care of yourselves and become an even bigger force for good in healthcare.